The opinions expressed on Inside the Black Box do not reflect those of WREK Radio or the Georgia Institute of Technology. Welcome to Inside the Black Box, a weekly program on science and technology, or as we like to think of it, science, only funnier. I'm your host, Pete Ludovis, and I'm not joined today by my ever-effervescent co-host, a man who's quick to point out that while corn-based ethanol is not economically viable as an automotive fuel, it is still economically viable as a beverage, Bill Hunt. Bill's on vacation up a little north of here, getting, I guess, a long-deserved rest. He'll be back in a few weeks. And unfortunately, our regularly scheduled guest, Paul Neitzel from the School of Mechanical Engineering, was unable to be with us today, so he's hopefully going to be with us the following Wednesday or sometime after that. So today we're going to do something just for fun. It's just me and our engineer extraordinaire Trent working a big board today, and we're going to talk about science in the movies, the accuracy of science in the movies, things like that. And I must say, when I was doing a little background research for this, I went online, and you've got, you know, physicists, engineers, chemists all upset over one minor inaccuracy in a particular film that might have been very well received, that a lot of people liked. And we're just harping on that. And this actually speaks to last week's topic, which is when we reviewed a National Academy of Engineering report on the perception of engineering by the public. And apparently, us engineers were our own worst enemy. We're geeks, and that's sort of the impression we're giving the people. So I want you to take everything we do with a grain of salt. Most of the movies I'm going to talk about today, I actually enjoyed. And by the way, Trent, that includes Ice Princess. All right. I know you were embarrassed to admit that you actually saw that film. I saw it because my daughter was probably 9 or 10 at the time, and she liked girly skating movies and things like that.
Yeah, but I wish I had that excuse.
Okay, maybe later we'll get into exactly why you did see that film. Did you lose a wager?
No, that was not.
Okay, well, did you like the film?
It was all right.
I mean, it was okay. I mean, it wasn't a bad film. But we'll talk about tremendous, I guess, inaccuracies of the scientific nature in some of these movies, and just use that as a segue to talk about some basics of science. So before we begin, let's start with science in the news. And today we're looking at an article from the Science Times section of the New York Times from July 15th of this week, entitled Taking a Cue from Ants on Evolution of Humans by Nicholas Wade. And it's really about sort of a new fight that Edward O. Wilson, the biologist who's written a number of very good books, including Social Biology and one of my favorites, Consilience, on sort of the big picture view of biology. It points out that though he celebrated his 79th birthday this month, Dr. Wilson is generating a storm of literary output that would be impressive to someone half his age. And he is engaged in another fight. Now, in his defense, Dr. Wilson, who has written some controversial works in the past, said he was not picking a fight when he published Social Biology in the year 1975, a synthesis of ideas about evolution and social behavior. He asserted that many human behaviors had a genetic basis, an idea that disputed, idea then disputed by many social scientists, and by Marxist intent on remaking humanity. Dr. Wilson was amazed at what ensued. He described the long campaign of verbal assault and harassment from a number of his Harvard colleagues, including Richard Lewontin and Stephen Jay Gould. The new fight, he points out, is one he actually is trying to pick. It concerns a central feature of evolution, one with considerable bearing on human social behaviors. The issue is the level at which evolution operates. Many evolutionary biologists have been persuaded by works like The Selfish Gene by Richard Dawkins that the gene is the only level at which natural selection acts. Dr. Wilson, changing his mind because of new data about the genetics of ant colonies, which is one of his primary research focuses, now believes that natural selection operates at many levels, including the level of the social group. Basically, you need to pass some behavior on in evolution, and that can either happen specifically by the genotype, right, the actual DNA pattern that manifests itself as some sort of physical attribute, the phenotype in a cell. But if we think about social behavior, there's no reason in my mind that you couldn't have actually this learned and then retaught behavior over and over and over again being passed down. So as much as it is a controversial idea, it at least has a basic logic to it. It passes what we like to call in science the acid test, that conceivably you can think of a mechanism by which this happens. Trent, any thoughts?
That sounds about right. I mean, you can just look at it, humans. I mean, when you get new technology, you do different things.
Right.
Children and parents are different.
Right. And now, with guys that work in computers like yourself, I mean, it's probably transformed what things like Facebook, MySpace, LinkedIn. I can't even name them all. Friendster, right?
Yeah.
The way we socially interact.
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that may be best done as a social behavior that is not necessarily a good thing. Is it good or is it bad?
I don't know. I'm not registered for them. So.
Okay, so you stay away from the social networking sites?
For the most part.
Okay, and you're a mathematician?
Yes.
One would think, so do most mathematicians stay away from the social?
I have no idea.
Oh, okay.
I wouldn't know if I'm not subscribed to their network.
So you actually have a life? A mathematician?
I guess.
With a life. Despite the fact that you did see Ice Princess by Disney.
Yes.
Well, that's okay. I'm not going to hold that against you. All right, so we're going to start talking about science in the movies. And this is a live show, so if you have an opinion about science in the movies, give us a call at 404-894-2468. Once again, that's 404-894-2468. And, of course, if you're listening to us on the web, on WREK.org, that number is published on the website. And we're hoping to get some calls today, providing the phones are working. What
yes,
do we got, a 50-50 shot that
50-50.
We think they're working? Because everyone's got to have an opinion on movies, right? I mean,
right.
Even engineers like myself like the movies. Our favorite movie, of course, is Engineers, Apollo 13. That's one of the movies we'll be discussing today. Because let's think about it. That's the one where we shine. That's the movie where we saved the lives of the dashing, debonair astronauts. You remember them. These were the guys that, despite the fact they were total jerkwads in high school, still got all the girls. So let me actually start with what I think is the most egregious error in movie making. And I will disagree with some of the reviewers on the websites that we posted on our website that you can go ahead and take a look at and see where astronomy and physics were incorrectly represented in various movies. And even they agree that some poetic license is okay. The biggest thing they're going to pick on is sound in space. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. And basically, just talk about the way sound works and why sound in space just doesn't happen. But let's be honest, if you took all the sound out of all the movies that you've seen, it would be pretty darn boring.
Right.
And we make the same faux pas, I guess, when we do underwater movies. I've been a scuba diver for years, and trust me, there isn't a lot of sound underwater. That doesn't mean you can't make sound underwater, right? The easiest way to do it, if you're a starting scuba diver, you might wonder why your dive knife often has a big metal plate on the end of it. Now, part of that's so you put the screw in there to hold the blade in, and it's an easy way to build it, but a lot of the reason that's there is so you can turn around and bang that on your tank. That's an easy way to make a really loud noise underwater, so you can get that. But all this bubble and slurping and swishing sounds when the moray eel jumps out of its hole to bite you in the leg of your wetsuit or something like that, that just doesn't happen. You need air there to expand and move and things
right.
like that.
I was actually watching a movie the other day, probably don't want to admit to watch it. It was Fool's Gold. It was some,
okay.
I don't know, random romance comedy for whatever reason I was watching.
That's okay.
But,
we are
this
not
guy,
going
yes.
to impugn your movie,
right.
movie-going habits.
This fellow was chained, like, underwater, and
right.
he took a gun and he shot it to break his chains.
Right.
And my roommate made the comment that shouldn't he be deaf because it's a very loud sound coming through the water.
Yeah, that's
and
a good question. And you got to wonder, I mean, first of all, for it to work, you need some oxygen.
Right.
right.
I mean, but that's a different
thing. And there might
thing.
Be enough oxygen in there
yeah,
in the powder.
Assuming right. it's going to work.
Right. Because water transmits sound very efficiently.
Yes.
Right? And over very long distances
right.
because of its density. So.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's 2 feet. It's going to be a pretty loud sound.
Yeah, that would not be very pleasant. That's a good question. So it wasn't very loud, or?
I don't know. It was
okay.
a gunshot. I assume
okay.
it was very loud.
Okay.
I mean, it was loud in the movie, but the actor could obviously still, or
yeah.
the character could still hear fine.
Right. And trust me, if you've ever fired a gun without those ear things.
Right.
Next,
it's loud
yeah,
in air.
It'll
be loud in water.
For a while. Yeah, absolutely. So there you have it.
Yeah, there you go.
Okay, so let me pick on what I think is probably not poetic license, but the worst failure of these things. And we're going to start with apparently Trenton Mind's favorite movie, The Ice Princess, produced in 2005 by the Disney Corporation. It stars Michelle Trachtenberg, Hayden Panettiere. I always pronounce that incorrectly. But she's the one that always plays a skater or a gymnast in all these movies. Or
yeah.
a cheerleader.
Right.
Right.
Well, that's what you play in movies nowadays.
Okay, I guess so. But and then Joan Cusack and Kim Cattrall were the mothers. And probably the biggest problem with this story, and it's actually a neat story. It's a good family film. It's about a girl who is a physics nerd, right?
Yeah.
So she's a physics nerd, and she decides to do her physics project on, on ice skating. Right?
Yeah.
So she videotapes ice skating, and she figures out all these moves, and it actually helps her friends who are ice skaters. But she makes a very, very fundamental mistake in basic Newtonian physics, that even if Disney, figure Disney's got money to hire consultants, even if Disney had a consultant who was a high school teacher, they would pick this one up. So I can't believe they didn't catch this one. And it has to do with the moment of inertia and that funny little experiment you do when you're spinning around on a lab stool. She's sitting there, and she pulls her arms in. And you've seen this in skating, right? They pull their arms in, and they spin faster. And she points out that she's pulling her arms in, thereby decreasing her moment of inertia and increasing the rate of spin. It's exactly the opposite. She goes increasing her moment of inertia. You're actually decreasing your moment of inertia. And since it's the moment of inertia times the rotational velocity equals your angular momentum is the thing that hasn't changed at all, then you spin faster. So it's exactly the opposite. But we're at about a quarter after, so we shall take a quick break.
If we want.
All right, let's take a quick break, and we'll come back and pick out other movies that made science and physics errors in their presentation. And again, if you've got a question or comment about a movie you've seen, give us a call at 404-894-2468.
Every Wednesday evening at 9 o'clock, tune your radio to WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM. For Destroy All Music, a program that plays something for everyone. That's Destroy All Music, each and every Wednesday night at 9 o'clock, here on the home of Quality Diverse Radio, WREK Atlanta, 91.1 FM. Turn it up. Get your weekly funk fix at WREK Atlanta 91.1 FM. The Electric Boogaloo throws it down every Thursday from 11 to midnight. Valix, L-Dog, and Treacherous are your funk doctors emeritus, and they'll even feature a guest lecture every now and then from the finest professors in groovology. You can hear all the funky grooves from the 60s, 70s, and even through today. That's the Electric Boogaloo each and every Thursday night at 11, right here on 91.1 FM, WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta. Apparently we have got a caller on the line. Caller, are you there?
Yeah, I can barely hear you, though.
Oh, bummer.
That's okay. I think we can work it out.
Okay.
I was calling about the firing the gun underwater and going deaf because of it.
Right.
Yeah, so the answer is no, he would not go deaf.
Okay.
The vast majority of sound coming from a gun when it fires is the projectile breaking the sound barrier. And so the water's going to keep that from happening, although the bullet would go pretty daggum fast underwater.
Right.
It's kind of the same way a silencer works. The silencer slows down the bullet, keeps it from breaking the sound barrier and therefore not making as much noise.
Right, because if you think about a bullet, the actual amount of powder in it, you know, isn't worse than a firecracker. But if you think about, well, that's a good point. Thanks for that.
Thanks.
So now, here's my question. Have you fired a gun underwater?
Or? I have not, but certain guns will work. One of the things, like a Magnum 357, they advertise it could crack an engine block. Another thing that they advertise about it is it can shoot underwater. Mm-hmm. Now, I, by no means am I a gun expert. The Mythbusters guys did some great firing guns underwater and through water, and whether or not it's lethal at certain ranges and stuff.
Yeah.
So that was a good show as well. But no, I have not.
Okay. But again, we were talking about the acid test before. That makes perfect sense to me, that breaking the sound barrier is a really loud thing. So
yeah.
I find that very plausible that that's the biggest component. So that seems very reasonable to me.
All right, guys. Take care. Right. Great hearing you.
Thank you so much.
Uh-huh.
Bye-bye. There you have it. Geeks out at large. All right. Are you going to go check that line, too?
Yeah.
All right, so my apologies, folks. Trent is like running to the other room to get the phone because the phone here right in the booth is blinking at us. So let's continue to talk about, well, we talked about Ice Princess, which, by the way, actually, if you're an 11-year-old girl, it's a great film. My daughter loved it. I actually think it's a great film. So in no way are we impugning the issues in Ice Princess, released in 2005 by Disney. The next one I want to talk about is Snow Day. It's a Paramount picture release from 2000. Directed by Chris Koch and written by Will McRobb and Chris Viscardi, about a snow day in upstate New York. I believe it's actually in Schenectady. And it stars Chevy Chase, Gene Smart, and Chris Elliott, and a cast of young adolescent kids who are actually quite good. And I thought it was an excellent movie. It's the kind of movie that, you know, if you're a, you know, preteen or a teen, you'll really enjoy it because all those guys love snow days. But the movie itself, I thought, was fine. Very, very funny movie. If you like Chevy Chase and those Fletch kind of movies, you're going to like this movie. Here is the problem. The problem is they try to get very fancy at the beginning. And they have, what do they have? They have the condensation of water molecules, and then they form crystals, and then they form snowflakes, and then the snow comes down. And they have a nice effect where they're decreasing their altitude, coming through the upper atmosphere. The problem is the little molecules they show condensing look like a little ball with what appear to be four little bumps sticking out of it. So anything that's a little ball with four bumps sticking out of it, more likely than not, unless it's a weird silane compound, which is unlikely because that combusts when it hits, you know, moisture in the air, it's probably methane. And if I'm wrong, it was actually three bumps, well, then it's ammonia. Either way, methane and ammonia does not exist in large clouds, you know, in the upper atmosphere. Perhaps, you know, right outside Taco Bell, depending on what time of day it is. But, you know, you can find methane and ammonia clouds on other planets, moons of some of the gas giants in our solar system. But instead of doing water, which should always look as a central atom with two things sticking out at about 110 degrees, they actually condensed methane. So I don't know who did their visualization, but that's actually what I do, a lot of computer visualization of molecules. Next time, give me a call, guys. Other than that, it was quite good. Have we got another call, Trent, or no? Okay. All right, this was just bill collectors harassing you? Is that it? Okay. So so actually, you were talking to me before about, do we want to do this now? Do we want to talk about computers? Okay. All right, I'm going to give you a second to get our public service messages lined up for the next break. And I'm going to talk about something I saw a lot of controversial stuff out on the web about, and that is one of my favorite movies, Mission to Mars. So Mission to Mars, if you actually go to the the first website we've got on our website here, which actually has sort of a report card for bad science. And it listed in several categories. So it says, for example, sound in space. Almost everything had a check in sound in space, with the exception of Serenity, Stargate, and the Alien movies. And in fact, as we mentioned before, while sound, as our caller pointed out, can clearly exist underwater, but the biggest contribution to the sound of a gun going off is probably the sonic boom of it breaking the sound barrier in air. And there is a speed of sound in water. The problem is the bullets probably slowed significantly, so it may not actually reach that. Sound doesn't happen because you have to have some matter, some molecules to conduct the sound, right? It's a vibration of things that gets conducted. So for us, it can travel through air, it can travel through water, it cannot travel through a vacuum. And most people believe that in space there's just a few molecules per cubic meter, so not enough to actually generate that rather interesting phenomenon. I will give a nod to Deep Impact, though, which is one of those asteroids hitting Earth movies, that and Armageddon, because it, you know, showed the sound of the drills on the asteroid trying to drill down. It was totally unrealistic because you wouldn't hear any of that sound of these little moles trying to drill down to deploy these nuclear devices. But I'll chalk that up to poetic license. As they were traveling back to the spaceship, they actually sort of had the camera inside the spacesuits with the astronauts, and all you heard amidst all these outgassing of you know, these various geysers on the surface of the planet as the sun was rising on the asteroid, all you heard was their breathing. They're breathing in their heartbeat, and that's exactly what it would sound like. So I think they sort of showed you a vignette of that, and then later showed you that that was unreasonable. And, okay, so let's see what else we got in here. You know, all planets have Earth's gravity, and they picked on Stargate for this one. But Stargate supposedly was a colony where this alien life form moved humans to. And if it was within plus or minus 5 or 10%, yeah, it could probably behave like, you know, a normal person, don't you think?
Right.
Yeah. All right. Trent's backing me up on that one. Yeah. Now, granted, if it were 50% higher or 50% lower, everything would look very, very different.
Right.
And actually, I want to use the second to last category. People move in slow motion in zero gravity. It picked on 2001 Space Odyssey, Space Cowboys, Mission to Mars for this, Enemy Mine. And that is actually an interesting point, that zero gravity just means that, you've got no gravity to push you against the surface so you can move relative to that surface. You can get friction on the surface and walk and jump. But if you're holding on to something, you can do a pull-up or a chin-up or anything just as fast. There's nothing slowing you down.
Right.
Not true underwater, though. And underwater, you got this viscous thing, and you're horribly, you're horribly, awkward. Is the right word. And I think of a time I was scuba diving near the Channel Islands in Santa Barbara, and in the time it took me to barely move an arm to sort of signal my dive partner, a small sea lion came up, went around me twice, came right up to my ass, looked me right in the eye, and then, you know, beat a hasty retreat, and I still couldn't even touch the shoulder of my dive partner to say, look, there's a sea lion looking at me. So you are much slower in water, but not in space. So actually, for Mission to Mars, oh gosh, and did I lose my, I don't think I brought my back of the envelope calculation. There was a big controversy on some of the websites about the Dr. Pepper incident. Did you ever see Mission to Mars?
I don't remember.
So this is the one with...
I saw something about Mars. There were two that came out at the same time.
Yeah, there were a lot of Mars movies, right? And they point out Mars is the favorite planet of the Hollywood set right now. So they had a small meteorite, infinitesimal, something the size of a pea or a BB or something even smaller than that, that just went right through the whole ship. And it caused, a leak, right? So it's very, very small. The outgassing is small. They've got this huge ship. So, the computer's saying, look, you've got a leak. We need to shut this thing down. And what happened is one of the guys was sort of looking for it, and they had various things leak through this, and I think one of them was actually Dr. Pepper.
Okay.
So somebody had, one of these pouches, a juice box sort of thing, and he squeezed Dr. Pepper out. And first of all, credit, I don't want to make any public, message about this, but I personally am a fan of Dr. Pepper, so it's nice to see that they would have decent soft drinks on a mission to Mars. That's all I'm saying.
I'm sure they have certain scientists working on that at NASA.
I would hope so.
Making sure they have a nice drink selection.
I would think so. So in any case, so the Dr. Pepper, he released it, and you got these little blobules of Dr. Pepper floating around, and of course they do form little blobs because of the surface tension of the fluid, and it eventually got sucked out the hole, and it froze and slowed the leak. Right, and what one of the websites that we have there points out is that, well, we're not sure this would actually happen, because if you think about it, it's going into almost zero temperature, right? So the temperature is almost absolute zero. People talk about, approximately 4 Kelvin, which is -269 degrees Celsius, or over -400 degrees Fahrenheit. So it's almost no kinetic energy whatsoever. And in fact, thermodynamically, you can have absolute zero, but this is darn close. It's much colder than liquid nitrogen, for example. So he releases this stuff, and it freezes, and that makes sense. But the problem is that it's also in zero pressure, so it should boil. So the pressure is making it boil, but the temperature is making it freeze. The problem is which one, makes things happen first. And if you think about it, and they make a very good point, that it's probably the pressure. So it would probably boil at first. And the problem is that there's only one way to lose all that energy in space, right? Because there are three ways to transmit energy or transmit heat. Lots of ways to transmit energy. But heat in general, you either have it conducted through a solid, right? And that can happen in fluids too. Or if the fluid is moving, right? So, for example, the way a convection oven works is it heats things up, and then that hot air rises, and then as it passes off that heat, it cools, and you get this nice circulation. That's convection. So that happens in fluids. That's why you want to stir something when you want to get heat transferred in it. But without any molecules, all you have is radiation. And radiation goes up very, very rapidly as the temperature goes up. So as you go down, you lose that ability to radiate stuff. So it's going to take a while for the heat to get out of the Dr. Pepper and off into the rest of space via radiation. So that makes perfect sense. However, if it does just transfer that radiative heat within itself, you could actually get a phenomenon where the boiling of the Dr. Pepper still requires energy. So to actually boil it, you have to require energy. And that's exactly why everyone has some Aunt Myrtle that lives out in Phoenix, and you say, well, doesn't the heat bother you? And she says, it's okay, it's a dry heat. That's evaporative cooling. We see that all the time. When you sweat out in Phoenix, Arizona, it's very, very dry.
Right.
So just it wants to vaporize because it wants lots of water in the air. Same thing in space. It wants to vaporize because there's no pressure. So part of it's going to immediately vaporize, but the energy to vaporize that still has to come from somewhere, and that's what cools your skin out in Arizona, and that's what actually might lead to the freezing. So they forget about evaporative cooling. I did a very quick back-of-the-envelope calculation, and that's exactly what it sounds like for those of you that have never done a back-of-the-envelope calculation. It's something you could fit on the back of an envelope and put down a few lines of basic mathematics and see, does this make sense? And I actually concluded that if you vaporize about 28% of the Dr. Pepper, you would have enough energy to actually get this thing down to, you know, a temperature where it would freeze. I don't know where it's going to freeze. I guess 50 Kelvin, which is a little colder than liquid nitrogen. You know, maybe it's higher than that, probably not lower than that. A lot of assumptions. I assume that Dr. Pepper had the heat of vaporization of water. I assume that it had the unchanging with temperature heat capacity of water. A lot of big assumptions there. But at least it says, okay, it's possible that less than half could vaporize and freeze this. And that may be off by 20, 30, 40%. But at least it says maybe that's an interesting mechanism for that sort of thing. And that's a really interesting thing, because they have another category in here. And I'm trying to read this here because it's in like very tiny type. I know it's in here. And it's something about weird things when people are exposed to... Yeah, here it is. Weird depictions of exposure to vacuum. So Tim Robbins, when he was floating toward Mars, actually the faceplate breaks on his spacesuit. And I know everybody wants to think that the depiction is more like Itchy and Scratchy in the Simpsons movie. Now, you did see that film, didn't you?
Yes.
That's a genre-defining film, if you ask me. I'm not embarrassed to admit that one. That, you know, your blood boils, so your head sort of expands or explodes and your eyes pop out and all sorts of things like
right.
that. But it's the same thing. You have the boiling, but you have the cooling. And these guys made the same assumption about the Dr. Pepper for Tim Robbins. And before all his, obviously he did have some boiling of his blood because you're in zero vacuum and the fluids in your body. But he very quickly froze after that. So they assumed that the freezing, the heat transfer, caught up to the mass transfer very quickly, and they pictured him as completely frozen. I don't really know what the answer is. But the point is, it points out that there are usually, you know, heat transfer and mass transfer issues and a lot of different things in science and engineering, including this particular movie, Mission to Mars, which actually I liked. So, I don't know. I mean, does that even count? We're not even doing movie reviews. Yeah, I'm easy. So don't take me as a critical reviewer of movies. So let's take a quick break.
Okay.
And then when we come back, we'll continue talking about this, including Trent's views on the depiction of computational science in the movies. You're listening to Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
Need something happy to help get you through your week? Well, tune into Gold Sounds, Tuesdays from 7 to 8 p.m. on WREK Atlanta for the best in indie pop and just that kind of music that sort of makes your heart happy. Once again, that's Tuesdays from 7 to 8 p.m. only on WREK Atlanta.
Welcome to the Quality Diverse Radio Cafe. May I take your order?
I'll have the Blue Pay special.
Listen to the Blue Plate Special every weekday except for Wednesday, noon to 1, to get your daily dose of jazz, classics, weekend, atmospherics, blues...
Hey, there's a finger in my food!
...and overnight alternatives, all in 1 hour.
¶¶
That's Blue Plate Special. Weekdays except for Wednesday, noon to 1. Here and only here on The Wreck. WREK Atlanta.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box, where we're talking about science and its depiction in the movies. So if you've got a comment or a question at all about a movie you've seen and how science is depicted in it, we're not going to guarantee we'll give you an accurate answer, but we'll tell you what we think anyway and use it as a discussion point about the basics of science and technology. If you do have a question or a comment, by all means, give us a call at 404-894-2468. And even after the show, if you've got a question or comment about any one of our shows, by all means, give us a call here. Or better yet, send us an email at, actually you can do that at Pete@InsideTheBlackBox.org. Again, that's Pete@InsideTheBlackBox.org. And again, we've got that and other email addresses on the website. Okay, so we were just talking about Mission to Mars and the evaporation / freezing of Dr. Pepper as it comes out of a leaking spacecraft.
Right.
All right, so let's get back to this sort of report card, and they talked about what is it? Weird depictions of exposure in a vacuum. So clearly, Tim Robbins counts as that. And to be honest, I don't know which one would happen, the freezing or the mass transfer quicker. But the one I really want to talk about is, gosh, I wish I could remember. If you remember this, give us a call if you've seen this movie. It's the one with Arnold Schwarzenegger about Mars, where...
Oh, Total Recall?
Total Recall. Okay, so Total Recall has to be the worst. And again, I mean, and when I say worst, I mean the worst depiction of someone exposed to a vacuum. Not necessarily the worst movie. So what do you think of that movie?
It's all right.
Yeah, I liked it. I mean, but it was more of a mystery intrigue movie.
Right.
Right? I mean, it was true science fiction. But basically, he comes popping out of the... popping out of the volcano there, him and this girl, and they're like, their heads are swelling, they've got this horrible edema because they're exposed to a low-pressure environment. So they're basically showing the boiling of the blood. And admittedly, this one might actually be a more accurate one than the one near Mars, because they're on the surface of Mars, and they are on the daylight side, with no atmosphere to, shield them. They actually would be absorbing a lot of heat that's being radiated from the sun.
Right.
The problem is it would scorch them to a cinder, probably. They'd be covered with second and third degree burns and all sorts of other issues. And what's funny is literally in a few minutes while their heads, I mean, it seemed longer than maybe it was 30 seconds. In 30 seconds while their heads are swelling up, which, by the way, would probably be irreversible when your head swells up to 20% its normal size. His eyes were bulging out. He'd probably be dead because of that. Then the water vapor and all this oxygen released from this frozen stuff in the center of the planet covered the entire planet. And trust me, the mass transfer rate of that, the time it takes for something to come out of a volcano and cover an entire planet the size of Mars, is not going to happen in 30 seconds. I couldn't tell you exactly what it's going to happen in, but it's not 30 seconds. And his eyes are bulging out, and then suddenly they go back in his head, and he stands up, and they're like, okay, we're good. So that was totally unrealistic, despite the fact it was a good sort of movie about intrigue and things like that. So... that's not mentioned on here, but that gives my vote for the weirdest depiction of anyone or anything exposed to a vacuum. Okay, so let's talk about things that are maybe not as egregious, that I think really fall in the poetic license thing. And I want to talk about Stargate from 1994, directed by Roland Emmerich, written by Dean Devlin and Roland Emmerich, starring James Spader, Kurt Russell. And have you seen this movie?
I have.
I love this movie.
I like that movie too.
And here's the reason I like this movie. I like this movie because of no criticism about the way it portrays science necessarily. Basically, they're going through a wormhole, an Einstein-Rosen bridge, whatever it is, and we speculate about that. And although they point out there was no sound in space in this movie, there was sound when they're going through the wormhole.
Right.
And I don't know about that one. But Contact did the same thing.
Right.
I mean, it was like a roller coaster.
They need dramatic sound in movies.
No, absolutely. To me, that's poetic license. I have no idea whether there's sound in a wormhole. I suspect not, but that's okay. I think even sound in space is okay. But the reason I like this, and I think Bill would agree with me, is it's very accurate depiction, not of the physics in the movie, but the way physicists, or in this case, I'm guessing what archaeologist, paleontologist, that's what
right.
He is. He specialized in, you know, Egyptian hieroglyphics. And he's giving a talk at some, you know, meeting, And he's got a very controversial theory, and he's trying to convince these scientists of this, and they're standing up saying, look, we don't believe a word you're saying, and this is ridiculous, and they all walk out of him, and he's depressed, and nobody's listening, and he's like, wasn't there a luncheon? You know, I don't think anyone's so rude as to, you know, get the whole group to walk out on you, but... Yeah, I've seen people just stand up in these meetings and say, look, your theories are nonsensical and ridiculous. And in the end, his theory was correct. And this is even of theories that are reasonable. Right. So to me, that was the most accurate depiction. And then he gets out, and this woman from the Air Force Project has him get in the car, and she has a job for him. And she's like, well, I don't know. She's like, look, and apparently this was back when, you know, surveillance of people was just the way it was today, because she said, your grants are expiring, you know, you can't pay the rent on your apartment, all these sorts of things. And it pointed out just how pathetic research scientists often are. All right, we may have a caller. Trent's going to go check and see. So that's what I definitely like about Stargate. And in this report card, it actually gets a ding in the category. Let me see if I can find this. Reproduction between humans and aliens. Of course, the most egregious show for that one would be the Star Trek series, where Captain Kirk met a lot of strange aliens. Here it is. Easy interbreeding between humans and aliens. But the truth is that was supposedly humans on the other planet that transferred there. So technically, I don't think that's deserved. So do we have a caller?
Yes.
All right. Welcome to Inside the Black Box. Did you have a question or comment?
I guess you guys are talking about alien human. I guess alien resurrection would be the one I was thinking of. But no, the question I called in initially was about a lot of my friends at work always argue about Star Wars stuff, and they argued about if the Death Star would... Hello?
Yeah, we're here.
Okay, I'm sorry. I thought I was the one put on there. But yeah, I was wondering if the Death Star would explode in Episode 4 of Star Wars the way that it did. They say explosions are possible in space and all, so...
Well, so that's exactly one of these categories, is they talk about sound in space, and everybody gets dinged with that, and I think there's lots of sound in the Star Wars films, and that's okay, because it makes the film better. But we know it's totally unrealistic. Explosions in space, the same exact thing. Most of them are not likely, because when we think of an explosion, all we need is a fuel, and we need oxygen, and we need heat. We have plenty of oxygen on the face of the planet. And the only difference between an explosion and burning is an explosion is when something burns at near the speed of sound. Its flame front moves at or near or above the speed of sound, and it pushes the air out of the way, and that's the shockwave that you get. I guess the problem is they always have sparks and fire in those things, didn't they? They had a lot of sparks coming out of that thing.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing it wouldn't look like that, but it is possible as long as you have oxygen, right? And the best example is you fire a retro rocket or a rocket, you know, from the Apollo program or the space shuttle, you see the flame coming right out the back, and that's because they carry big tanks of liquid compressed oxygen or some other, you know, oxidizing compound.
Right.
In this case, it is oxygen. So I guess we don't know enough about how much oxygen was sitting on there.
Right.
So explosions are possible as long as you have oxygen. And let's face it, they must have had oxygen on that giant thing, right?
Yeah, somewhere.
Yeah, so I think you would have an explosion, but would it look like the sparks going out? And here's the other thing. Would you have that funky little ring that goes out in a plane? Definitely not. There's no reason you'd have that plane of a shockwave coming out there that glowed green or yellow. I'm trying to think, what's the other one? Armageddon, the way they do that explosion is totally unrealistic, too. They have this weird conical shape coming out of it. So explosions are possible, but would it look like the one in Star Wars? I'm guessing probably not.
Okay.
All right. Well, we appreciate you calling.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thank you. Yeah, and I don't know. I mean, what did they get any tape of Apollo 13 when they had one of their stirred tank? It was a liquid oxygen tank.
Yeah, I'm not sure.
Yeah.
I mean, that was back in the 60s. So.
Yeah, and that was long before your time.
Right.
That's what you're saying.
That's what I'm saying.
Actually, ironically, Apollo 13 and The Right Stuff were the only movies on this website. This is the first website that's listed on our website that get a clean bill of accuracy. But again, I like Mission to Mars. And let's face it, Space Cowboys was not a movie about space. It was a movie about old people in space.
Yes.
I'm doing comedy in an independent living group in a couple of weeks, and actually I got to think about Space Cowboys. So I really like that film, but you're right. Things were blowing up, and there were sparks and all sorts of things in space and things like that. But again, I don't want to ding Stargate too much, because the guys went to this other planet and then he met this girl, and I don't think there was any they just were like dating at that point. But that's very possible, because supposedly these were humans, and they were transferred there about the time of the ancient Egyptians. So we're talking a few thousand years, and I have a hard time believing that after a few thousand years, things might change a little. Maybe they're a little shorter, a little taller, whatever.
Yeah.
But I think we'd still be able to reproduce.
Right.
So
it'd be really hard to find extras that look very different than humans.
Well, that is the problem. I mean, isn't that why all aliens in the original Star Trek series were humanoid-ish? Because, you know, the latex rubber and the suits and the...
I like the girl that was painted blue.
Right, that's exactly it. And that was the 60s and the 70s. It's easy to just paint somebody green and say, well, there you go, there's your alien and things like that. So, I don't know. Let's see, what else do I want to talk about?
Probably
here?
Take a quick break.
All right, so let's take a quick break, and then we talk about computers.
And if you want. Sure.
All right, let's do that. So we'll take a quick break. You're listening to our discussion of science in the movies. Again, if you've got a question or comment, give us a quick call at 404-894-2468 here on Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta.
Of the 1.3 billion people living in absolute poverty, 70% of them are women. Why care?
I've learned better farming techniques and have been able to grow more potatoes than my family needs. Selling them at the local market has allowed me to send my children to school.
Why care?
I am powerful.
She has the power to change her world. You have the power to help her do it. Visit care.org.
This is your radio friend, Joe Bizard, inviting you to tune into my country music classics here on WREK at 91.1, Friday evenings at 5 o'clock. We come alive at 5 with great old-time music. String bands, bluegrass, old country blues, a little of everything, jug bands, anything that you can imagine, you'll hear on the country music classics. Oh, happy music. A little jug band. Don't forget, this is Friday at 5. We come alive right here with the Country Music Classics on WREK-FM 91.1. Make it a habit. Tune in. I'd love to have you. That's Fridays at 5 right here on WREK 91.1.
Welcome back to Inside the Black Box on WREK Atlanta, where we're talking about science and movies. So let me move on to one of my favorite movies, and it was written by an actual scientist, right? This, of course, would be Contact, based on a book written by Carl Sagan. So it actually is scientifically accurate. And again, I'm not sure we can ding a lot of movies on these websites for faster-than-light travel. Right now, our understanding of the relativistic nature of the universe is that nothing with a non-zero mass can go faster than the speed of light. Of course, we can talk about wormholes and things like that, where the universe is folded. It's a manifold such that you can jump from one part to another in our three-dimensional spatial coordinates by taking advantage of these other dimensions. Who knows if that really exists? Theoretically, people talk about them existing. But even Isaac Asimov, who wrote the Foundation trilogies, talked about faster than speed of light travel because it makes it interesting, because that's the only thing that makes intergalactic travel really feasible. And he talked about us realizing that there was something beyond the relativistic universe, just like we knew classical physics, then we went to quantum physics and relativistic physics. And who knows? It's very possible. Isaac Asimov, for example, like Carl Sagan, was a PhD scientist. He was a PhD chemist. So who knows? And I'm willing to grant those guys some license. What I like about the movie Contact is when who played the main character there? I'm having a senior moment here.
I can look at
Jodie Foster.
Yeah, okay.
Right. So Jodie Foster comes in, and she's like, you know, they're being transmitted as prime numbers, right, which no one would mistake for a natural phenomenon. If you had the prime numbers yeah. between 1 and 101, no one's going to say, oh, it's just a harmonic of something.
It occurs
right?
in nature.
Right, exactly. So you wouldn't make that mistake. And then apparently whatever the main carrier frequency was, she said hydrogen times pi. So we think of, well, hydrogen's, you know, an atom. What do you mean by hydrogen times pi? But hydrogen, like any atom or molecule, has all sorts of frequencies at which things oscillate, right? Infrared radiation is when you've got molecules vibrating. You know, they're bonded to each other, right? And probably what she meant is not necessarily that infrared, you know, two hydrogens vibrating back and forth. Who knows? She may have meant that. But she might have meant actually something in the radio frequency thing, and that's the electrons. So the electrons can jump up to the next highest position and the next highest. And when they come down, they give off a photon, right, a light particle that has a particular frequency. And there's more than one. So there's the base one, and then there's the next one, and the next one, and there's jumping all around. So there's these whole spectral lines of hydrogen, which, by the way, is how we know stars are formed out of hydrogen, and there's big hydrogen clouds out in space. But you wouldn't want something exactly on hydrogen, and you wouldn't want something that's a nice multiple of two of that, because you might get a harmonic.
Right.
So what you'd want is some weird irrational number multiplied by that, and you'd have to pick a number that every society would know. Doesn't have units, you'd have to know it. Pi is something that every society would know, because the idea of a circle is such a simple one, and that being the ratio of the circumference to the diameter of a circle. So when she said hydrogen times pi, I told you, I mean, apparently she was looking for that. You'd have to be off the main frequencies of hydrogen, otherwise you'd never see it, because right. it would get absorbed by all the hydrogen in the universe. And then pi seemed like a likely thing to do.
Sure.
So that's what I like about that one. Being
real accurate. Quick, we had two callers, didn't want to go on air, but they had some comments. One fellow said that Space 1999 is a good example of a show that follows science pretty well, in his opinion. So
all right, Space 1999, was that the one where we had the colony on the moon?
Maybe.
I'm trying to remember that one. I love that show. Yeah.
Yeah, I look up.
He's looking that one up.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the other caller wanted to bring up the point that Star Trek was done on a very shoestring budget, so that is why many of the things are the way they are. And it's very funny that it affects science and technology, like, you know, people design things or whatever, the way they do, just because it was so cheaply made now.
Absolutely. But, and that's the point. Whatever inaccuracies you see in any of these things, we're just using them as an example to talk about science and technology. Inaccuracies in any modern movie or TV series, I think, are perfectly fine. And I think the whole sound in space, the whole going faster than the speed of light, and explosions in space are totally reasonable poetic license. Because I got to tell you, I would not like the Star Wars movies as much as if you know, you wouldn't do that.
Space 1999 is Moonbase Alpha.
Right, so Moonbase Alpha. And who starred in it? Was the guy that was in Mission Impossible?
Let's see, starring Martin Landau.
Yeah, I love that show. That was a great show, actually. Yeah, I don't even, and that's the thing. I can't even think about whether or not I thought it was accurate or not, because I just like the show. We don't watch these shows because we worry about the scientific accuracy. We're just doing that because we're nerds, and we're using it as an example to talk about various things. So you wanted to say something about, what was it?
We were talking about, you know, differences in how things actually are portrayed in their movies and such. So I know a good bit about computer security and such. And in most movies,
this is what you do for a living.
Yeah.
You have a real job.
Yes,
so you only do
job.
This out of the goodness of your heart.
That's right.
Okay.
All right. So yeah, most movies that do anything with computers and security, they're just absolutely terrible.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, take the last example, it's like Live Free, Die Hard. It's just...
Oh, I didn't see that movie. Really bad in the computer security?
There was some plausible things, but lots of ridiculousness. Or the classic example is just Hackers from like 95 or 93, just... crazy things going on. But I just wanted to mention that, like, the Matrix, the second Matrix, if I think it's when Trinity is breaking into a power plant or something, if you actually, like, take a still frame and look at her screen or something, which people will do because, you know, people have too much free time.
Right.
But if you look at her screen, she's actually using, like, a vulnerability in the software from the time period when the movie is supposed to take place. So not only is it an actual way to break into the system, but it's actually from the correct time period.
Oh, right. So was this a Unix-based system?
Yes, it was.
Okay. So, and I remember when you...
She was breaking into SSH. It was an SSH vulnerability from the time that the movie was taking place.
SSH is secure...
It's secure shell. It's just a way for administrators to log into the system.
Right.
And there was a flaw at that time, and she used it.
And I remember a lot of those flaws that the original Berkeley Standard Unix guys left in there because it was a convenient way for them to go in and fix systems.
Sure, yeah.
Exactly. Wow, so that's good.
Yeah, news. It was entirely accurate. It was very weird.
All right. So let me actually mention one, a movie that I probably have mentioned before. And believe it or not, if you go look up the Journal of Materials, there's actually in 2004, there's a guy who I believe it was, let's see, issue 3, volume 55, James J. Robinson, had an editor's list of great material moments in movies. This is from the Journal of Materials. He pointed out a lot of films, and actually some of the ones he left out were foreign films. So I'm gonna plug one that I really like, The Man in the White Suit. I actually show excerpts of it occasionally to students to illustrate how polymers are formed. And it's from 1951, and let's see, it originally came out of the UK, and it's been sold so many times, I'm not even sure who actually owns the rights to it now. But it starred Alec Guinness as a polymer chemist, believe it or not. And it's a polymer chemist who gets the girl. That's the crazy thing. How often does that happen?
I don't know.
The polymer chemist never gets
not
the
enough,
girl.
Not enough, I would
and,
say.
And there are no other movies about polymer chemists. And it illustrates how the importance of molecular weight plays into polymers, right? That the higher molecular weight, the stronger the polymer, the stiffer the polymer, things like that. And in theory, what he made was a polymer of infinite molecular weight. That is, that if you pull a 9-meter thread of this thing and you weave it into a yarn, and the polymers are actually that long. You have to break the bonds between them, and that is many, many times harder than to get the individual molecules to slide past each other. And he literally made something that was so strong, it was stronger than steel, and not on a per-weight basis. It was actually stronger than steel.
Right.
So there's a great scene where they're testing the tensile strength of this, and they're pulling and pulling and pulling, and it's doing thousands and thousands of pounds per square inch, and it actually snaps the thing that's holding it on there. Off. So to me, that's a great one. And it's actually about the social commentary that maybe beautiful materials and perfect science isn't always good, because it put the entire textile industry, washing industry, clothing industry out of business. So that's the point perhaps we want to leave you with, that science movies aren't designed to convey the world's most accurate science. They're
right.
Designed to convey social commentary on science and its role in society and how people interact with
there
it.
There are implementation details to their
right,
theories.
Exactly. So accurate science is good,
yes,
but some poetic license, like sound and explosions in space, we think are particularly good.
Are way more entertaining.
Yeah, and I think the only thing you want to avoid is things that are just blatantly horrible, like these examples, you know, you alluded to of, you know, very bad computer science.
Oh, yeah.
It's much harder to hack a system than they show it on a lot of these things.
Yeah, sometimes.
Okay. Well, at least for some of the people I see in these movies. And, you know, things like, you know, just getting the momentum of classical physics wrong in The Ice Princess and condensing methane in, the snow day, is something you probably want to avoid. So
yeah.
Find yourself an actual scientist and use them as a consultant. That's,
you have Caltech right there. You can just go
right, exactly. You have Caltech, or come out and visit us at Georgia Tech. We'd be happy to set you straight. All right. Well, thanks for joining us on our foray into the movies and science as it's represented there on Inside the Black Box here on WREK Atlanta.
We are the shadow mental health system in America, unheralded and unsung.
Dr. Joyce Berland of the National Alliance on Mental Illness says that families provide 50% of the care for people with mental illness.
And the families are the ones that are, you know, taking to medication, taking to this, taking to that, going after their family members in jail, trying to get them out of jail. It's a real firing line that families live.
Many times, families feel isolated.
Support groups have been spontaneous reactions to that isolation. Support is a human necessity.
Be a moral support for families dealing with mental illness. For more, visit the website shadowvoices.com. For free information on families coping with mental illness, call 800-999-3534. A message from the Mennonite Churches and Faith and Values Media.
Stay in touch with your inner college student, WREK Atlanta.
Earth and Sky.
This is Joel Block. Recent thinking suggests that Saturn's rings are billions of years old, and that Saturn recycles its rings and even creates new ones.